The words of Peter. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us a new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead and an inheritance that will never perish, spoil, or fade, kept in heaven for you who are right now being preserved by the power of God for the day of salvation, which is ready to be revealed. In this, you greatly rejoice, even though you've had to suffer trials of many kinds. These things have come so that the preciousness of your faith may result in praise, honor, and glory on the day Christ is revealed. Even though you can't see him, you love him. And even though you can't see him now, you believe in him and you rejoice with an inexpressible joy, for you are right now, this moment, receiving the end of your faith, which is the salvation of your own soul. The word of the Lord. I would call that Peter's almost Gettysburg address. It's this short little burst of maybe 3-4 minutes long that suddenly reminds us who we are and what reality is. This is the moment he acknowledges that we have serious problems and yet tells us that a day of great hope is coming. You notice, for example, Peter didn't say that the last time was coming. He said the last time was being revealed. The day of salvation, the salvation of your souls, is not something in the future that's coming. It's something already true that's being revealed. Are you there? All the difference in the world of saying something is in the future and it hasn't happened yet, but that day is coming, and saying something is already true today, we just can't see it. It hasn't been revealed. And the day of your salvation, or the salvation of your soul, isn't something that's coming. It's something that's already there, but you can't see it. It is slowly being revealed. I know this is heady for the first 3 minutes. You're like, holy cow, can I go get a coffee? Think of it like this. God has two pictures of you on his fridge. Is that a little easier? One is the before and the other is the after. And you are right now somewhere between the before and the after. He has an image of what you look like when you fully become the person you were created to be. You are not that yet, not on this day, but you are on your way to becoming the person you were created to be. That is your full salvation. Now, are you, maybe there's two more have just begin to see it? This whole journey that we call salvation involves a series of multiple conversions. Conversion simply means to change, to pivot, to turn away from something into something else. The trouble is that we in the church have used it exclusively to define the day that we became Christians, but that's not what it means. The word means to change, to turn away from something into something else. So clearly, we're not going to say that the day I became a Christian was the last day I changed. Please tell me that isn't true. More change has happened since we became Christians. Those seasons in your life where something big is, and you're becoming something you never were before. Maybe it's some deconstruction. Old things are starting to be taken down, but you're also starting to think, wait a minute, I'm not going to do that stuff anymore. I'm going to start doing. That's like a conversion moment. And there are several of these things. And what Peter has just said is every one of them is moving you closer to the day when your salvation is revealed, to the day you become the after picture on God's fridge. You're getting there. I know it's quiet. You don't look excited. You're getting there. Part of that journey, says Peter, is trials of many kinds. But these things come, he says, so that the genuineness of your faith, what one translation, the proven character of your faith, the reason you have trials is so that the genuineness of your faith might be both revealed and developed. God is just putting more weight on the bar. He is forcing you through a number of different situations that this morning you call trouble. It's stuff that you hate. And your tendency, at least if you're like me, is to look at situations and start blaming people or blame systems or talk about injustices and quotas and organizations and leaders. And as long as we do this, we're looking at what is happening to us, and we can't see what is happening in us while this stuff is happening to us. By nature, when something goes wrong, there has to be a culprit. Somebody has to have made this whole thing go. Why does there always have to be a culprit? Why can't we just say God is using people and systems and rumors and injustices and quotas and things that we don't like, but God is using these things that drive us crazy in order to prove the character of our faith. This is a good thing. It just doesn't feel like it. How are you? Are you all right? The moment we can make that change, the moment we no longer talk about all the stuff that's happening to us, we start talking about what's happening in us. Now the focus shifts. The problem is no longer your adversary. The problem is your ego. An ego is not pride. Pride is a symptom of unconverted ego. But ego is the problem. And sometimes it makes you proud, and sometimes it just makes you cynical. And sometimes it makes you mean. Sometimes It makes you incapable of losing an argument. That isn't pride. That's ego. When you look at a photo, a group photo, and you're in it, who do you look for first? Like, I mean, have you ever looked at a group photo and then looked for yourself last and then said, wow, everybody in this picture looks really good. I look like a dork. Let's use this one. When you have an argument in your head, have you had these? Have you ever lost? That's ego. When you draw a picture in your mind of taking a last shot with a second and a half on the clock, have you ever missed? That's ego. You imagine an award being handed out to the most prestigious, accomplished, successful person, and we give the award to what? Gary? No. That's ego. Ego is the narrative that you create about yourself. It's the story you tell yourself about yourself. And so ego thrives on separation. It has to distinguish itself from other people in the room. And it generally does this by creating a narrative of intelligence or superiority or extraordinariness. Ego is the part of you that feels peculiar, a little distinct. It's the part of you that feels entitled. Well, other people might deserve this, but I don't. That's ego. And there will come a day when God will tell your ego the truth. To convert it. Do you have the nerve to listen to it? For Peter, that day happened within hours of Jesus's arrest. I won't belabor the point. You know the story. I'll tell it quickly. Matthew says, when evening came, Jesus was gathered with his disciples at a meal. This is a Passover meal. Passover is a symbol of God's loyalty. So right in the middle of a symbol of loyalty, Jesus looks and says, one of you are going to betray me. And there's a silence in the room. What did he, did somebody say something? What just happened? And then one by one, the disciples go around the room and say, Lord, surely not me. In part, it's because they don't think it's them. And in part, because they want Jesus to exonerate them. They want him to say, oh, no, Nathaniel, not you. That's ego. I'm in a moment where Jesus has just said, one of you will betray me. I need to create in my mind a narrative that says, others will do it, but I never will. That's separation. That's ego. Are you tracking? Jesus said, no, it's the one who puts his hand in the bowl with mine. It's the guy who shares the meal. And then Judas says, Lord, surely you don't mean me. That's in verse 25. But 10 verses earlier, look it up. In verse 15, Judas has just gone out and made a deal for 30 pieces of silver to betray him. He knows full well he has just betrayed him. Now he's looking at Jesus as if, what are you? I would never do this. What are you talking about? You just did it. Judas is pretending to know things about himself. He thinks Jesus doesn't know. And then Jesus says, you're the one that said it. And then right then, right at that moment, Jesus starts to break the bread and hand them the cup. And I can't get my mind around this, because what Judas has done is an iconic act of evil. There is not a moment in the history of the world, in my opinion, more dark than this. You take the only innocent human being that ever lived and you betray him. You are a monster. It is in the middle of that act, Jesus is giving himself away. Oh, gosh. Then Jesus turns and says to the disciples, in fact, every one of you will walk away from me. And then Peter, he stands, oh no, Lord. Other people will do this, not me. Do you see what he is doing? He is creating a narrative again that says, oh yes, Lord, it is human nature to walk away from you, but I am not human. He is creating separation between himself and the rest of the disciples. There are others. Nobody's doubting that this will happen. What we doubt is that it'll be me. That's ego. Jesus says, well, as a matter of fact, it will be you. Three times before the rooster has crowed, even once, he can't hear it. Peter says, absolutely not. I would die for you. And all of the other disciples said the same thing. Can we have a come to Jesus for a second? Have you ever overestimated yourself? Have you ever drawn a line of separation between yourself, your character, and somebody else's, your behavior and somebody else's, your intelligence and somebody else's? In a way that makes you look just a little peculiar. Last January 1st, New Year's Day, had a conversation with Lori, and I said, you know, I'm sort of tired of New Year's resolutions. Why don't you write mine? She said, what? I said, well, figure it out. Nobody knows me better than you do. So why don't you just write my New Year's resolution? What is it you think I should be more or less of? Maybe break a habit and maybe start a habit. It was crickets. She didn't say anything. I thought I stumped her. That's ego. Then she said, well, I'm trying to figure out which one to tell you and how I should put it. I went, what? Well, just say it. And then she said it. And by the way, it ain't any of your business. And when she said it, I said, what are you talking about? I don't do that. And then she gave chapter and verse. I mean, instance after instance. And this, holy cow, it was like the day of judgment right there in the living room. She gave instance after instance the last 6 to 12 months. And I was like, well, you'd like taking notes, but every one of these situations were true. The minute she said it, I thought, well, like, well, yeah, I did sort of, but that's not what I meant. But the, no, that's a, but which is the nature of self-deception. It's not that we lie, it's that we truly don't know. We transmit ourselves to other people and are not aware of the impact we are having. We're not mean, we're not stupid, we're not deceptive, we're blind. This is that moment when Jesus says to Peter, listen to me, you are capable of doing things that would scare you. And you don't even know it. Let me ask you, what does Jesus know about you that you don't know? You say, well, that's a trick question. If I don't know it, how would I know it? All right, let's move to the second one. How would he tell you? And if he told you, would you believe him? How do you know? Or would you shoot the messenger? Or would you say, well, that isn't true? How would he tell you? How do you know you would believe him? Do you have a history of this? And if you believed him, what would you do about it? Do you really have that kind of power? Do you have that kind of agency? Or is thinking that you have that kind of agency part of the self-deception? If the only appropriate response to revelation of our true selves is not to say, I will do better, but Lord, have mercy on me. Oh, no, 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 Jesus, you're wrong about me. You're right about them, maybe, but you're definitely wrong about me. But then what happens is the guards come to arrest him, and when they arrest him, Peter is there, and Matthew says as soon as they arrest him, Peter draws out the sword and says, oh, man, not on my watch, and whacks the guy's ear off. Jesus picks up the ear, puts it back on, and it stays. And Jesus says, put it away, Peter. Do you not think if I wanted to, I could call on my Father? He would give me 12 legion of angels. In the Roman army, there's between 5,000 and 6,000 soldiers in a legion. So the translation is, Peter, if I wanted to, you don't think I could call down 60 to 72,000 angels? And remember, Peter, one of them wiped out Egypt in a night. You don't think I could call on 60,000 more and they would do anything I wanted? No, no, no. This is the way it has to go. Put it away, Peter. And then Peter watches them lead Jesus away in chains, and he starts to have a conversion. He's starting to replay the videos. What did I just hear? What did I just do? And what is happening right now? And Peter follows at a distance. He goes after him for a little while, and he goes into the courtyard. And while he's in the courtyard, there's a fire, and the soldiers are there warming themselves. And Peter stands around the fire, and one of the girls that are there said, wait a minute, you look like him, one of those that was with him. And Peter said, no, no, I don't know what you're talking about. And someone else looked and said, well, yes, That is you. I think I saw you with him. And this time he calls out an oath and said, absolutely not. I don't know the man. He takes a few more steps away from the fire. And by now a group has started to form like a little mob. And one of them says, wait a second. You are one of them. Even your accent gives you away. You've got to be one of them. And this time he says, in the strongest of terms, I swear to God, I've never heard of, I don't know him. And we don't know why he's doing this. Part of me says he's afraid. Part of me says he's just thinking, man, I don't want what's happening to him to happen to me. But part of me says he is disappointed in God. The God he believes in is not led away in chains. He conquers people. He doesn't take a beating. And this one is taking a beating. And I can't understand this. And you say, well, man, why can't he figure that out? We don't know it either. You understand, this is like a Copernican shift in this guy's mind. He's hearing for the first time that the earth is not the center of the universe. He's like, what? You're telling me there is a God who gets led out in chains and killed by a bunch of Romans of all people and religious people too? And part of me says what he's denying is that caricature. He's saying, Jesus, I know, but I don't know him. So he's hurt. Do you feel it? Do you see it? There's a deconstruction happening in this man's life right now. He doesn't even know what's ahead of him. And the moment he said it, the rooster crowed. And all of that came crashing back into his mind. He just went, that separation, that ego, it just went, I'm not any better or different than anybody else. Jesus turns and looks at him. Doesn't say anything, just looks at him. Peter sees him and he runs off into the night. Some of the reason we don't confront those, what are they, accusations? Some of the reason that we don't listen to people when they say hard things is not because we think they're wrong, it's because they might be right. And if they are right, We think, dear God, what am I going to do? I feel like I'm just all right. Everything you say is true. Now what? I just sit here. This is Peter. If you're anywhere close to that right now, if you've heard some things from God lately and they're hard for you, please, I beg you, listen to them. Sit in them. You're in the middle of a conversion. You just don't know it. It feels like you're losing something if I do that, but actually something is being born right now. Please listen. 3 days later, Peter, haven't heard from him in a long time. Jesus has come out of the grave. And he's looking for Peter. According to Mark's gospel, on that Easter morning, when the women came to the tomb, they found the stone was rolled away. The body was gone. They turned to walk away, and suddenly in front of them was an angel. And this is what the angel said, he is not here, he is risen. Now go tell his disciples and Peter. I didn't make that up. That's right in the text. Go tell his disciples, comma, and Peter, comma, that he is going ahead of you into Galilee, and there you will see him just like he said. Do you hear it? You almost hear Jesus looking for Peter on resurrection morning. Go tell his disciples, and by the way, make sure you tell Peter. But it is not so he can hang it in his face. It's so he can bring Peter back. One morning while Peter is out on the lake with some of his friends in a boat, they're fishing, haven't caught anything all night. Jesus is walking on the shore of the sea. He looks out and he says to the disciples, hey, cast the net on the other side of the boat. People, he is 100 yards, a football field away from that boat. You can't see where the fish are, a football field away. But he says, cast your nets on the other side and see what happens. Peter throws his net on the other side. Bam! He feels that familiar drag on the net and he hauls up 153 fish. The disciples look to the shore and they go, holy cow, that's in the Greek. It's Jesus. And Peter looks and he dives overboard, leaves the disciples in the boat. I mean, if it's me, I'm swimming the other way. But he starts swimming toward Jesus. And when he gets on the shore, he noticed Jesus has started a fire. It's like he's recreating the scene on the night he was betrayed. It's like he's asking Peter to come back to the scene. Come on. You can do it. Go there. When Jesus gets up next to, or Peter gets next to Jesus, Jesus has fish over the fire, and he says to Peter, why don't you take some of your fish and put them next to mine? You don't need my fish. No, I don't, but why don't you take some of what you're doing and put it next to some of what I'm doing? And they cook them, and the disciples start to eat, and nobody says a word. Everybody's thinking the same thing. What's he going to say? Is he going to say, Peter, why? Peter, I told you. How do I know that you won't do this to me again? Can I trust you? None of those. He says, do you love me? Well, of course I do. Well, then feed my sheep. A moment later, Peter, do you love me? Lord, is there an echo in here? Of course I love you. Well, then feed my sheep. Peter, one more time. 3 for 3. For every denial, a confession. Are you sure you love me? He says, Lord, you know all things. You know full well that I love you. Then he says, feed my sheep. That's when it occurred to you that when you've had that dark night of the soul, that moment where Jesus has called it out and told you something about yourself you didn't think was true, and it was really true. In that moment, the only question that will save you is, do you love him? No promises, and please, no explanations. Just play it where it lies. Do you love him? Start there. If you don't, there is no path forward. If you do, there is a bright future.